welcome to the Drive Podcast. Ted Henley is off for a couple of days. I'm your guest host, Jalen Nye. We have some great conversation on our show today, so let's get right into it.
Pope Francis will be at the Sacred Heart Church in Edmonton in about an hour's time from now. He was at Mascouche's earlier today, where we heard the apology from Pope Francis, driven back to the city after that. And yes, there will be a ceremony, and it's a private event at the church this afternoon. Tomorrow, the papal mass in the morning, and then Pope Francis will head to Lac Saint Anne for the pilgrimage. We know that it has been a powerful day for many. It has been a tough day for many as well. Our next guest is a member of Ermineskin Cree Nation. He is also an assistant professor at the University of Alberta, a faculty of Native Studies and Political Science, and was in Mascouche's today. Matthew Wildcat joining us this afternoon. Matthew, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for making time. Matthew, call to action number 58 in the Truth and Reconciliation Report was an apology on Canadian soil by the Pope. You were there today. You heard it. Mm-hmm. Where's your head at this afternoon?
Yeah, you know, more than anything, I'm exhausted because I had to get up at 5 o'clock this morning in order to beat the road closures out there. You know, for me, I didn't have any expectations of it. So my cooka, my grandmother, and my Muslim and my grandfather both attended residential schools. Same with my great cooka. My dad was a day scholar. Even myself, I actually attended 1 year of the federal government-run day schools. But, you know, I wasn't looking to get anything out of it. What I was hoping for was just to experience the event and the emotion and the energy and the atmosphere, so I could tell people in the future about it. And for me, there was a lot of things that I didn't expect. At certain points, there was a triumphant atmosphere, almost, I think, during the grand entry. You know, a lot of the clapping and applause that came when the Pope apologized, like his most clear expressions of apology, it just felt incredibly genuine and sincere being out there. And when he was given the headdress, there was it was almost like a delighted response in some ways. I don't know if people were not expecting that, and then it was just such an interesting moment. That, you know, there's lots I could say about it all, but those are kind of some of my initial thoughts.
Yeah, Matthew, when I think it was Chief Littlechild who put the headdress on the Pope, and Chief Littlechild has met the Pope a number of times over the past number of years, but the look on the Pope's face, the smile on his face, seemed really quite genuine. And I'm wondering about the meaning of that. Headdresses come with a lot of great weight, and I don't mean weight as in pounds. I mean weight in this is something you are now you carry the responsibility of having been gifted this. What did that symbolize?
Yeah, so, you know, headdresses are for people who have had leadership accomplishments, right? And who have had accomplishments which have enriched the community. It's meant to signify that you are, a competent and capable leader. And usually it requires a lot of effort, a huge amount of work, and, you know, a very long record of success in order to achieve them. And so, you know, I know there's been criticism of the headdress, especially on social media. And, in some respects, there's a bit of a cringe factor because, you know, is delivering an apology equivalent to what is usually decades of service when you're an Indigenous person to get a headdress. But we have to kind of view it as an act of diplomacy, right? This is a head of state, and when you honor someone with a headdress, what you're doing is you're adopting them into the community, right? Mm-hmm. So he is now an honorary chief of Urbanskin Cree Nation, the Pope, right? Or an honorary chief of Muscogees, however you want to read it. And so now he's, in a way, he's a member of our community. But I think it's also fair to for people who have, you know, criticized the decision to say, is that what we want out of this either, mm-hmm. right? Like, you know, and so, you know, I think I'll just leave it at that. Yeah.
Matthew Wildcat joining me this afternoon. I thought it interesting that the Pope in his speech today, he acknowledged institutional blame, but also made it clear that he said Catholic missionaries were merely cooperating with and implementing the government policy of assimilation. He termed the colonizing mentality of the powers and asked forgiveness, in particular for the way in which many members of the church and religious communities cooperated with, mm-hmm. you know, promoted by the governments of that time. The significance of him pointing out the government involvement as well, in your mind?
So, you know, I have to go back and look at the text, and, you know, and I was so honed in on just experiencing the moment. I know for certain just some of the early things I'm hearing is, you know, many people felt that he didn't take enough, he didn't apologize on the institution as a whole more forcefully, right? And so it's like, you know, many of this, many of that, again, you know, the critique there is that he's locating it just to individuals rather than the action of the institution as a whole. But I think one of the, you know, because this is a criticism of his Rome apology, right? And what I think, though, is when he connects it to this policy of assimilation of the federal government and to a larger strategy overall, he's recognizing that the harms that were done aren't just, you know, physical and sexual abuses against individuals, but it was a larger ideology at play, which placed people on a ladder of a hierarchical ladder of, you know, Christians being superior to Indigenous peoples. And that in order to deal with Indigenous peoples in North America, the best way was to get rid of them, mm-hmm. right? That we would no longer exist as legal and political entities, and that the church played a role in that policy of assimilation where, you know, up until 1969, the federal government was very clear that how Indigenous people should be dealt with is that eventually they would just no longer cease to exist, right? We would be gone. And so I think, to me, there was at least some recognition from the Pope that the church played a part in this awful form of thinking, which continues to have repercussions, in part because that way of thinking, I think, is still around for some people, for lots of people, in fact.
Matthew, the Pope talked about an important part of the process will be to conduct a serious investigation into the facts of what took place in the past, and this is from his speech, and to assist the survivors of the residential schools to experience healing from the traumas they suffered. What does that look like? What is the actual next step?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. When he said that, you know, I was pretty sure that's what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission did. Like, you know, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission laid out the truth. Marie Wilson, she was one of the speakers earlier in the day. Mm-hmm. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission talked to 7,000 people across the country. Like, they've gathered an incredible amount of truth. But one of the people that they didn't talk to actually was very few people on the church's end participated. And very few people who are perpetrators of violence and harm participated. And that actually distinguishes it from, say, the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission after apartheid, where people who were involved in implementing the policy of apartheid got up and discussed what they had done, right? And oftentimes apologized for it and felt a great deal of sorrow. So, you know, I don't know if there's a lot to collect on in terms of Indigenous peoples, but we've had to say about it. I think we've talked about it ad nauseum, but certainly the church could probably say a whole lot more about its role in all of this, for sure. I feel like there was a second part of your question that I dropped out that I'm missing.
Oh, no, I'm just like, and what's next? What is the actual next step, right?
You know, it's really hard for me to be invested in. A lot of people are saying this is a first step, and I'm like, a first step towards what though? Like, you know, in many ways, you know, Indigenous peoples participate in the church in far less numbers than previously. For the church itself, I think it's a first step of it developing new ways of thinking about Indigenous people and new ways of thinking about its past. And church members, for them, certainly, they have to really be committed to it being a first step. But from a relationship perspective, the people who are in the best position to ensure healing within Indigenous communities are Indigenous peoples themselves. Like, you know, the schools out of Muscogee, the Muscogee Education Schools Commission, I did an interview with National Public Radio, and my dad was involved in that. And it ends by, you know, my dad saying, you know, what is, who is in the best position to heal is us taking care of our own institutions, creating supports, mechanisms of healing, and creating a community where people can be helped along in whatever journeys they need to undertake, right? Whether that is journeys of forgiveness or whether it's journeys of anger, but of still, you know, getting your life together and being able to live a life that you're happy with, even if you are still angry with the church, right?
Matthew, we're going to have to leave it there this afternoon. I could talk to you for the next hour, but we're going to have to pause because I'm out of time. Let's do it again sometime. Thank you for making time for us this afternoon. I sure appreciate it.
Great. No worries.
Take care. Matthew Wildcat is an assistant prof at the University of Alberta in the Faculty of Native Studies and Political Science. He's also a member of the Erminskin Cree Nation. Right. You know, it has been a wild year when it comes to real estate and mortgage news, from the skyrocketing housing prices to rising interest rates. It's made buying a home a real challenge for many, and for others, simply out of their reach, something that's just not going to happen. How much do you need to be making to afford a house? Well, you guessed it, a whole lot more. James Laird is the co-CEO of RateHub.ca, president of CanWise Mortgage Lender. He joins us this afternoon. Hey, James, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you on the show. How much of a difference has those interest rate hikes had on mortgages?
So it's really had an effect on how much income you need to qualify for the average home. So, for example, in Calgary, you need $108,000 of household income to qualify for the average home in Calgary at the moment, and that's 18% more income than you needed just in March.
Wow.
And the story in Edmonton is similar, where you need 17% more income than you did just a couple months ago.
So when we talk about the stress test and the challenges there, for those who aren't aware of what that is, can you explain it to us?
So the stress test is simply, it'll take the mortgage rate that you're paying. So for example, fixed rate mortgages are around 5% right now for a five-year fixed rate. Now that is the rate that you'll actually pay. That is what your monthly payments will be based on. The stress test ensures that you could afford to pay 2 percentage points higher than the rate that you're actually going to pay. The thinking being, by the time your mortgage comes up for renewal, rates could be higher than they are today. So they want to ensure that the household could not only qualify for the rate you're going to pay, but actually a rate that's 2 percentage points higher. And so that's, you have to pass that stress test to qualify for the mortgage that you want to buy the home.
So, James, how could it work then as that stress test increases, you know, that like for every 1% that stress test increases, I think you qualify less for the mortgage. How does that impact if you've got like, I don't know, 60 or 90 days to buy a house?
Well, the good news would be that you can get a pre-approval, which holds your mortgage rate for 120 days while you go out shopping. And by holding the rate, you're essentially holding the stress test, because once again, the stress test is 2 percentage points higher than the rate you're actually paying. So, you know, for consumers who purchased, let's say, a couple months ago when rates were lower, they would have been stress tested at a lower rate, and they would have known what their stress test would have been. That is assuming they found a home within that kind of 4-month period that their pre-approval would hold for. So, you know, you can manage it a little bit, but, you know, the stress test has gone up. A few months ago, most people around the country, including in Alberta, they would have been stress tested at 5.25%, and now the average stress test is above 7%. Mm-hmm. And so that reduces your affordability by about 20%. Wow. Each 1% higher the rate of the stress test, it reduces affordability by 10%.
And, I mean, in housing affordability and being able to afford a house right now has been a challenge at the best of times, right? I mean, the prices were really on a roll there earlier this year.
They were certainly. Now, it's certainly not just an Alberta thing. And when you zoom out a little bit, Alberta actually still looks quite affordable. Yeah. on a national level. I mentioned you need $108,000 to qualify for the average home in Calgary. Using Victoria as an example, you need $187,000 to qualify for the average home in Victoria and $231,000 to qualify for the average home in Vancouver. So Alberta's definitely, the real estate has appreciated, rates are up. But on a national level, it is still looking like one of the more affordable places in the country.
Your best advice these days then, James?
Well, if you're going to go shopping for a home, get a pre-approval. It'll hold rates for 120 days. And, you know, one thing I've been thinking about is some of the heat is out of the market. There's less people going around and shopping for a home. And so we are seeing way less bidding wars than we were seeing in the last couple of months. So even though rates are higher, it actually might be a more comfortable time to buy because you won't be competing with, you know, nine other people in Calgary for that home. So it's becoming more of a balanced market, perhaps even a buyer's market. So there are pros and cons to the market right now.
All right, James, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks for having
me. Take care. James Laird is the co-CEO of RateHub.ca. And some interesting numbers from RateHub.ca when it comes to the change in required income to buy a house in just a few months. In Edmonton, it's almost $13,000. In Calgary, it's $16,500. You know, how old were you when you bought your first house? Right? Like, I didn't buy my first house till I was 30 when I moved to Edmonton. I'd been working for, I don't know, 10, 12 years in television in Ontario. My first husband and I moved to Edmonton, and we bought a place here, I think for just over, I think, $120,000, little tiny place over in Allendale. And, you know, loved that little house. But even then, I mean, that was, you know, for us, it was a big deal. But boy, oh boy, how things have changed, obviously, over the past 20 years when it comes to that. And I'll be honest with you, I have not had, except for that buying that first house, I've only bought two houses since then. When I got divorced, bought the townhouse, and then my husband and I bought the house that we're in now. Buying and selling homes has been some of the most stressful moments in my life. And possibly the least enjoyable. There's a lot of pressure on, there's a lot of stress, you're dealing with a lot of different, you know, people and all that. It's a real challenge. It's really important to find the right person to deal with, right? Because boy, oh boy, it has, I don't know about you, I have not enjoyed the experience. Maybe I've just had the wrong people. Very likely, I've just had the wrong people helping me out. But, I almost lost a house because of mistakes. Almost, you know, because the bank didn't do something and the realtor didn't do something. And it was crazy. It was crazy. And it was really, really frustrating. I would be loath to buy another place. You know, thankful that that the house that we're in, we plan on being there for a very, very long time. But, oh, just a stressful, stressful time. So, again, make sure you're finding someone who you connect with, right? Who can guide you through it all. Someone who you trust, who you believe in.
Hey, I'm Ted Henley. Thanks for listening to The Drive Podcast. Please tell your friends about what you're hearing. Also, please rate, review, and subscribe. This podcast, of course, is free wherever you get your favorite content. If you want to hear The Drive with Ted Henley live, then please tune in or stream the show weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on Global News Radio 770 CHQR.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone.
Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.